on the happy Thanksgiving for those who are celebrating in America. And I want to welcome everybody to our Thanksgiving, you know, special on behalf of Torah Motion. It's a pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Dr. Zev Elif, who is the Chief Academic Officer at Hebrew Theological College. I think that's the official name of the Skokie Yeshiva. He's also an associate professor of history at Touro College. He's an expert in American Jewish history, written quite a number of books, and it's a pleasure to welcome him here on Thanksgiving, talking about getting a foothold in America. Bakasha Zev.
Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman and Torah Motion, and so many faces I recognize. It's really tremendous always to join and to see names and faces. It's tough to talk about the silver lining of COVID. There's really no silver lining. And I was just talking with Rabbi Kelman about I'm one of those people who's just Googling the word vaccine over and over again. But at least we have spaces and reasons to innovate and reasons to gather on this holiday. A happy Thanksgiving. I see that I won't call it a legal holiday. I think it's a holiday. I think it's something quite important, maybe from a professional point of view, from a scholarly point of view, I have to think that way. But Thanksgiving and its turkey traditions in particular, I think are a reminder of how we take for granted our community and our culture transplanted to the new world. I think that our conversation relates to whether or not you're zooming in from the United States or from Canada, Mexico, Israel, wherever you're from. I think that there's something very curious about how halachic culture in particular, or maybe even rabbinic intuition, migrates to the United States, particularly around the 19th century. And so what I want to look at are really three case studies, but I think most centrally is the issue of Turkey. That if you know, some of you are an hour or two ahead of me, so depending on how large your turkey is, you may already be putting it in the oven. But when we talk about the 19th century, can't talk about a rabbinic culture in North America until the 1840s. That's when Rabbi Abraham Rice travels from Central Europe to the United States, first in New York and then in Baltimore. Rabbi Abraham Rice was the very first ordained rabbi to come to the United States. With his arrival come a trickle. Max Lilienthal, Isaac Mayer Wise, various people who come, mostly of them would identify Orthodox, at least to begin with. But after Rice arrives in Baltimore, and of course, Baltimore is a Catholic, I've written about this, a Catholic area. So the Catholics know how to treat their clerical authorities, although Rice does retire for a bit because he's unhappy there. It's not very hospitable to rabbinic culture in North America. After all, this is a country that revolted against authority. Nevertheless, Jews in the Americas required guidance on basic Jewish law, not just on council. And for that, very often the junta in the Spanish Portuguese synagogues that would flourish really in the 18th century, the 1700s, they would write lay leaders in who essentially we call them synagogue trustees in this time period. The synagogue was the main center of Jewish life. They would write these lay leaders, these trustees, to their counterparts in Amsterdam and in England, lay leaders, with questions about Jewish law. Do you have to wear a tallit when receiving an aliyah? Could so-and-so who has committed certain infractions, they had intermarried, can they be buried in a Jewish cemetery? Various laws. It would be lay leader corresponding to lay leader. And in Europe, they would query their rabbinic establishment, but it would be lay leader to lay leader communication. The one exception initially was London. You had in America, as more and more Jews in the Americas, their first language was English. It made good sense. And a colleague, a friend of mine, Adam Mendelsohn, has made the argument about an Anglophone, that just means people who speak English, diaspora. With, you had many, many Jews in the Americas corresponding with Jews in Montreal and in England and South Africa, in certain areas in Asia. You would have this community of people, especially because they would trade with one another. They would live in port cities. So from an economic and a social, a religious and a cultural point of view, it made good sense for to have these interactions. And so immediately in the really preceding the arrival of Rabbi Abraham Rice to Baltimore, you had a line of connection between Jews in the United States and Jews, particularly in England. And in England, because of the Anglican Church, you had a very strong rabbinic culture. In fact, for many, many years, there was only one rabbi in England. That was the chief rabbi. Everybody else was demoted, had a different title, a reverend or most likely a reader. There was only one rabbi, the chief rabbi, but the first before you had a chief rabbi, and we'll get to him in a little bit, you had Rabbi Solomon Herschel, who was an Ashkenazic chief rabbi, pseudo chief rabbi. And that's important because whereas many of the Jews who settled in the Americas beginning in the 17th century in 1654 were of Spanish Portuguese descent, they were fleeing the Inquisition quite literally, especially when the Portuguese had invaded Brazil. That meant that the Inquisition in 1653 was moving to the Western Hemisphere and Jews had to escape. That's why the first 23 Jews settle in what was then New Amsterdam, because they were fleeing the Inquisition. That was still very much they were in the throes of it, still so many years later. The first, though, Ashkenazic rabbinic power was Rabbi Solomon Herschel in England. And his Beit Din, in the 1830s, he dies in 1845, writes the following under his leadership. Chalila ba'avonotenu harabim ruba deruba. Deruba deruba makom agun yechashivu beprat bidoreinu ze asher America, Asia, v'Africa ke ibura shel ir London yechshivu. Because we are dispersed, because we make mistakes, trust me, acknowledges Rabbi Solomon Herschel, that these communities, particularly English-speaking ones in America, in Asia, and in Africa, they are considered, they are part of my province, they are part of my district. America had revolted against the English. That was in 1776, this is in 1830s, so you're talking about 60 years, but nevertheless, the Jewish community there, he claims, are beholden, and rightfully so, are beholden to his word. Sometimes these people do whatever the heck they want. Ya'asa. Sukkim, and they were very biblical. They used us as a verse in Shoftim. Asher bein Lila, that's a pasuk in Yonah. Lo noda mahayelo ve'ilu efo nasu haruach lalachad lo noda mekomo elo. These people, they're in far. They don't know up from down. And what happens? They all make mistakes. Rabba mikshla beprad be'America, and specifically those Americans. They don't know what they're doing in terms of Jewish law. Yarimu yad. Anashim b'li shame. These people who have zero credibility, zero reputation, lo yadu b'tiv gerushin. They don't know anything. And this is not just, I mentioned a couple of areas of Jewish law, but where do you really need a rabbinic scholar? In the area of kiddushin v'gerushin. You really, truly need a rabbinic supervisor to administer life cycle marriage contracts for the fear of messing up, essentially. They don't know what to do. And so they rely, claims Rabbi Herschel's Beit Din, his court, America relies on me. And so when Rabbi Solomon Herschel passes away in the 1840s, the British jury decides that they are going to institutionalize a chief rabbinate. I should probably just say a word, is that just how we're still really in the Shloshim Yom of mourning for Rabbi Sacks, who of course was such a leader, and the Kelmans obviously brought Rabbi Sacks so vividly to this Torah in Motion community, and it's quite sad to think about a world without Rabbi Sacks. His predecessor, the first chief rabbi, though, in 1846, was Rabbi Dr. Nathan Adler. And so Isaac Leeser, an important quasi-rabbinical figure in Philadelphia, we're going to be traveling around the United States today, writes the following in his newspaper. We have received for publication the following correspondence between a committee of the Franklin Street Synagogue in New York and the chief rabbi of Britain. Our readers are perhaps aware that the members of that body are mostly natives of Great Britain. This is referring to a congregation called Shari Tefila. Hence, it was perfectly natural that they should seek the opportunity of Dr. A's installation. So this British folkway that had migrated to New York, Leeser admits that these people, they're meshubad. They are very beholden to Rabbi Adler, to Chief Rabbi Adler's appointment. But it's not just him, and not just them, excuse me, to send him a congratulatory address, more so than any other congregation in this country. Nonetheless, the reverend gentleman will have many others in America who anxiously watch the good he may effect, as his ministration, if carried out in the proper spirit, cannot be otherwise than beneficial to American Israelites. And here you have, see also there's a deep dark secret in the scholarship of American Jews, particularly in the 19th century, when the synagogue accounts for so much of the primary sources. Historians tend to use synagogue histories and synagogue archives in minutes that are legible. So much is chicken scratch and they're lost to us, but this is pretty good. Is the letter from Shari Tefila in 1846 on February 24th to the chief rabbi. That's this letter from the chief rabbi to this community, thanking them for their gracious note of congratulations and testifying to the fact that he will be their chief rabbi as well. He is highly flattering of what they had said, if you read it. And I believe just a point of order is that all of these slides will be available through the Torah in Motion website. So please, if you want to review them afterward, happy for you to do so. Here you have Chief Rabbi Adler saying, I will be your chief rabbi as well. Another issue that comes up, which speaks to the lack of a foothold of what is, and that's really what I'm trying to get at today, which is when does America, or if does American Jewry gain a foothold? Is there such thing as a tradition that can be cultivated here in the United States? What the sources that we reviewed so far with Solomon Herschel and with Nathan Adler suggest is that there is a reluctance both on the part of American Jews, but also the rabbinic establishment elsewhere, to allow for the development, for the fortification of an American Jewish tradition. And here you have a traveler. You've heard of Marco Polo. You maybe have heard of other travelers. Tocqueville, of course, is Alexis Tocqueville is, of course, somebody who traveled from France to the United States and wrote about it in the 1830s. Some of you may have heard of I.J. Benjamin. He wrote a German travelogue, which translated into English. And toward the end of it, he seizes on a very curious issue. He's traveling. He's at the end of his trip. He's there in the 1850s until the 1860s. And in the early 1860s, he's in New Orleans, one of the largest Jewish communities in the United States at that point. And he records the following. After the discussion of my affairs at the above-mentioned meeting had been concluded, the president of congregation, Shari Chas, had requested the meeting to remain a little longer because he had something else to say. So they had finished. He's recording that, does Benjamin, that they finished their regular synagogue business, but the president of the synagogue had something else to talk about. He informed the meeting that the Portuguese congregation had disclosed to him that they wished to set up a statue of Judah Turo. Turo had passed away in the mid-1850s to the lasting memory of the man who had been a benefactor of so many congregations, and that they sought the assistance of the other congregations of New Orleans in the project in the hope that other congregations in America would also join in it. The truth of the matter is that Judah Turo had left a very substantial will that was actually going to be administered by none other than Moses Montefiore. And it was up to Montefiore's discretion and his fellow trustees of how the will would be executed, who would receive funds. And this New Orleans Jewish community had figured that if they establish a statue of Judah Turo, then maybe that would ingratiate themselves to the trustees and they would receive money for it. It's a very good fundraising tactic, at least so they thought. Benjamin was very unnerved about the suggestion. And you see in the source, he accounts for the fact that he was astonished and he asked the person next to him what exactly is going on. Perhaps they were speaking in English. He was mostly a German speaker. He wanted to make sure that he understood what was going on, and he felt obligated, therefore, to raise his hand and say in the second paragraph, "Gentlemen," I said, "although I am only passing through the city and therefore have no right to take the floor in the discussion of community affairs, I see myself forced to express my views in this matter because this concerns our religion. And in such a case, every Israelite has the right to speak. The democratic America, after all. When I was young, I spent much time in Jewish studies and have recently seen Fort Confidence. He's a traveler, after all, and have learned something at first hand about millions of my fellow Jews. So I have a rare point of view," says this visitor, Benjamin, to the Jewish community of New Orleans. "I know what's up, not just in American Jewry, but world Jewry. I've seen it all. Nowhere did I see or find the statue of a Jew, because this is clearly against the principles of our holy religion. My words caused great excitement among the religious Jews at the meeting, and it was accordingly terminated at that point. Eventually, by this is the 1860s, there are, the American rabbinate does weigh in, but Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, Rabbi Adler, Zacharias Frankel, and others are queried about the acceptability, most of them think it's absolutely forbidden based on a Gemara and a Avodah Zarah, to establish a statue of an image, of a graven image of a human being. But here you see that, what is his point? He claims to have, I confess that I haven't seen the German version. I don't know how Jewish studies was translated from the German. But here's somebody who has demonstrated a certain level of conversance. He is literate in rabbinic literature. His appeal is based not on the on the sources, but he thought it was most compelling, did Benjamin, to tell these Jews in the Americas that what you're doing is wrong. To set up a statue is wrong because everybody else hasn't done it. America is not entitled to establish a tradition. Another issue, and we'll get to Turkey in a moment. Let me just be 1 second. Right, okay, we're on the right page. Here is Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, one of the leading rabbinic figures in Central Europe at the time. He was a young man, so I gave you what he looked like as a younger rabbi. on the issue of etrogim. Why are etrogim so relevant? Is because the way that etrogs look, the way that they're harvested in California, and particularly in the Caribbean, look very different than the etrogim that we handle today. And that's what's really important for our discussion. Writes Rabbi Yaakov Enlinger with very curious scientific suppositions. Nistati, im anu yoshve Europa, yotzin bedalad minim shigadlu baye America. I don't know if we in Europe, who apparently some were considering or did import etrogim that were harvested in America, in the Americas, in the Caribbean, shigadlu baye sheyoshvin tachtinu. Apparently, he thought that America was in the southern hemisphere. And just the opposite. That the scientists, the botanists, they thought that if you think about a globe, they were on top and they were on the bottom. So our feet are somehow juxtaposed to one another, if you can imagine it. Who nipnei sham habore ko moshech ba'aretz. The imkain. And if not just we are on different sides of this orb called the planet Earth, but also trees grow in different ways, meaning they grow opposite one another. The imkain. Haminim shegadlu sham im notlin etzleinu hu hafuch. Mider gdilatan she'etzleinu gadlu roshe halula v'hadas ha'heim yoter lamata mizonam. So there's the halacha teaches us is that you have to wave a lulav the way that it grows in its direction. If that's the case, then we don't know. Again, suppose Rabbi Edlinger about his incorrect assumption of where the Americas were in relation to Europe, we wouldn't know how to wave them. So I don't know what to do. And so he's mesupak and he's in doubt, and therefore he would rather us not use the etrog trade that was coming from the Americas. We should stick with the European ones. But there was also the issue of the Caribbean etrogim don't look. And here's Rabbi Abraham Rice. I had mentioned him before. Just want to make sure that I'm, see there are, just want to make sure that I'm not missing any of the questions. Maybe I'll handle the questions at the end. Here you have Rabbi Abraham Rice, who is combating a rabbinic outcry, or even a lay leader outcry, really, coming from Cincinnati, which was a large Jewish community at the time, that etrogim in the Caribbean are grafted. They don't look right. We can't use them. They look very different than the ones that we were accustomed to using from Europe, the ones that were usually harvested from Morocco or from the Greek islands, Corfu. Why is this interesting? Because of the following letter. The rabbi, who actually would come to New Orleans, it turned out, Rabbi Moses N. Nathan, writes to Isaac Leeser, again, that rabbinic editor in Philadelphia, commenting about how aggrieved he was, how upset he was over the outcry trying to suppress the Caribbean etrog market because these etrogim looked white. They looked more narrow. They kind of looked like footballs, white footballs more than anything else. It must also be recollected, writes Nathan to Leeser, that our Portuguese brethren in Jamaica were presided over for many years by eminent chachamim. The chief chacham, Yoshua de Cordova, an eminent scholar in biblical and profane knowledge, and whose manuscript writings attest his profound acquirements. Surely, these pious and orthodox persons would not have sanctioned the use of grafted fruit. So there was rabbinic leadership overseeing the Caribbean for centuries, and writes Nathan about his indignation that how dare we try to quell, or how dare we try to eliminate a perfectly good tradition of using these Caribbean etrogim And in fact, they probably weren't grafted because they grew. This is what Rice had written in the previous slide. They grew in the wild. This wasn't the main crop of the harvesters in the Caribbean. They wouldn't have spent so much time on it. So from the halachic, from the cultural, social perspective, but also from the tradition perspective, Mesorah, that's really what we're getting at today. There was a Mesorah. There was rabbinic leadership or oversight of these Caribbean etrogim. And so what Nathan is doing and tearing his hair out over was because aren't we entitled in the Americas to establish a tradition? And so even in the 1850s, that was our, if you see these sources come from 1847, but by 1850s, when there is a Rabbi Yosef Schwartz, who's in his, he's from Eretz Yisrael, he comes in the 1850s, as he writes in his Tshuvot, they were published about a decade later, Im Kain, and I'm looking in the bolded section, Vadai Kesherim, he himself thought that these Caribbean etrogim were fine. Haim Libnei America, they're perfectly good for Americans. Ki Darkam Gleham Kain, alluding to the Rabbi Edlinger, Tshuva, he says they grow just fine. Neha Medina, the Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger, Tshuva was well known to Jews in America already by then. Ubnei HaMedina, Ahi, Ragilim Behim. Everybody should use them. They do use them. V'chein Asiti, Halacha L'maisa. And I, when I visited the Americas in 1850 and 1851, I used them. Shevarachti Alehem. I didn't think that it was saying God's name in vain. I made a brach on it, blessing on him. It wasn't a brach levatala. The Chag, I said it on Sukkot itself, on Shnat, Tafreshud, and Tafreshud Alf, 1850 and 1851, Be'et Ani, Begola, Ba'aratahi, when I was in the exile, particularly in this area. Shadavka, and then you look in the next section. Yes, in fact, they're more authentic than the yellowish etrogim that we're accustomed to in Europe. They grow in the wild. They are perfectly fine. The fact that he has to justify that is really important, but even more so, the fact that Jews are using them, that they are establishing a tradition, even before he gets into the halachic business in the second paragraph, and the first paragraph is really important because here you have something that's quite anomalous, is that justifying halachic practice based on the fact that people are doing it. There must be an established tradition. They must be doing it from an authentic and a good, I guess the only word we could say, a Masoretic position. And so Rabbi Schwartz in 1862 says it's perfectly fine to use these etrogim. Now we get to Turkey in the same context. There is a Rabbi Rosenfeld in Cincinnati who eventually takes up the same issue in Charleston. The same issue plays out. The sources are more interesting during his first bout in Cincinnati. He is the rabbi of B'nai Yeshurun there, and he's getting into trouble. And they arraign him on a number of charges. And this is very common for rabbis to be fired. Rabbis usually did not get more than a year or two of contract. They were poorly paid, poorly compensated, and even demote him. They call him a Mr. R, Mr. Rosenfeld, rather than a rabbi. It's a question of whether or not he had rabbinical ordination. And the charges are as follows. First, he ate meat of the hind quarter. It's the Gira Nasha issue. It wasn't properly separated. Number two, he was accused of traveling, of riding the railroads on when it was Shabbat, when it was the Sabbath. And then number three, let me move this item from Zoom here. That Mr. R, this is Jacob Rosenfeld, had eaten guinea fowls. Although in some places they do not eat them. Mr. Lewis contended that this was his opponent, according to Yoredeya, Simon Pei Bet, we do not eat any bird except it be traditional, that it is permitted. To this, Mr. R replied that in Charleston, one of the earliest Jewish communities, they had such a tradition. And in fact, the issue continues about it. And here is the Oxen, but here is the Asmonean, which is quite interesting. about this community in Cincinnati. Here is a traveler, not going so far as Benjamin did from Europe to America, but somebody else from the Americas, and it was written anonymously under the nom de plume B'nai B'rith. We don't know who this was. I found Israelites writing to a New York Jewish newspaper. I think that's the first time that I used the word New York in this lecture, which is maybe a record for trying to decentralize it from American Jewish history. Not my intention. I found Israelites in Canton, Columbus, Springfield. Wasn't visiting the Football Hall of Fame. It wouldn't yet be built. Dayton, Ohio. But my business did not permit me to spend a long time at any of those places. I remained for some considerable time in Cincinnati, Ohio, the Queen City, and center of the West. When I previously had reflected from what I had read of them on the, I think it's status of the Israelites in that city, I was at a loss for an opinion or to anticipate what I should find there. He didn't know what to think of Cincinnati. I had read of continual quarrels among them about the shochtim and butchers, about eating hindquarters and guinea fowls and other such things. I was fully posted up. I was fully posted up in the knowledge of Rabbi Mr. Henry, and Reverend Mr. Rosenfeld. That's the person who was both fired. Rosenfeld, in particular, for eating this bird, which did not have a Masorah, a tradition attached to it, had been their ministers, and that even they were not orthodox enough for the people. Reflecting on all this, I concluded that Cincinnati must be inhabited by men who still live in an age of superstition and ignorance. He was not exactly so sympathetic to Orthodox Jews. But when I had considered that they had just unanimously elected Dr. Wise, this Isaac Meir Wise, the same shul that had fired Rosenfeld for eating a bird that lacked a Masorah, and we'll see exactly what that means in a moment, had hired the architect of Reform Judaism in 1853, just a few years later. So there is some cardinal sin about eating a bird without a Masorah, something that is antithetical to the religious culture and the rabbinic culture of the Americas that we have to still establish. So what is it? Let me stop sharing. I apologize. Let me bring that back. I promise there's more. There we go. So what is our business? Simon Pei Bet. Let's learn it together. Simanei Of Tahor, Lo Nifaresh Mina Torah, Ella Mana minim tmeim bilvad v'shar mineha of mutarim v'haminim hasurim, and there are chaf dalid murmbatar. So the signs of a kosher bird are not explained from the Torah. Rather, it only enumerated the non-kosher types. We only know that if it's a predatory animal, that's not allowed, and the permitted types of birds, and the prohibited types 24 were mentioned in the Torah. So we don't know what's permitted. We only know what's forbidden. And you see, I bolded the operative sections in Simon Bet of this Yoreday is the same section that was read to Rabbi Rosenfeld, Reverend Rosenfeld, for why he wasn't allowed to eat the guinea fowl and turkey, obviously, maybe it's not obviously, is part of the same controversy. Kol mishehu baki ba'otam haminim ushmoteim harizeh ochel kol ov she'ino mehem. So anyone who is an expert in those types and their names, behold, he eats all the birds that are not from them, and he doesn't need checking. Anybody who knows what's kosher and what's not, it's fine. V'of tahor na'achol b'masorah. And what do you need to know in order to know that a bird is kosher? You have to have a masorah. You have to have a tradition. V'u shahaya davar pashut b'oto makom shizat of tahor. All you need to know, according to the Shulchan Aruch, is that there is such a tradition that people ate this bird, this fowl, and then it's good. Continuing on. However, that's only the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah, the Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writes in his gloss in Simon Gimel, V'yesh omrim she'en lismoch afilu al zeh, v'en la'achol shum ov, ela b'mesorat shekabuba, shehutahar v'chein noagin v'en l'shanot. The Ramah writes, and there are those who say, even, and this is on the commenting on whether or not if you could size up from its anatomy whether or not a bird is kosher. The Ramban nevertheless says, there are those who say that we don't rely even on this. We can't, there are no indication, there are no markers that could somehow validate a fowl's kashrut. Rather, one should only eat a bird with an accepted tradition that it is kosher, and we are accustomed to this and should not be changed. So the Shulchan Aruch, which is the dominant work, or as my teachers taught me a useful language, it is the default for halachic abiding Jews, particularly for Sephardim. The Rama in his gloss offers, there is no way to get markers or approximations of what is kosher and what is not. The supreme value and really the only determining factor of whether or not a bird can be consumed is whether or not there is a masara. Umishu mimakam shenahagin iser ba'ot echad mibnei she'en lahem masaret b'halach lamakam she'esh lahem bo. So if somebody who has a tradition in his community or her community, that a bird is not kosher, and then travels to a place, b'halach lamakom, she'esh lahem bo, mesaret yachol la'achla, b'makom shahalach sham. So if somebody in Fargo, North Dakota, travels to Vancouver, Canada, and what was no good in Fargo is accepted based on a tradition in Vancouver, that person can rely on Vancouver traditions and consume that bird. Yachol la'achla b'makom shahalach sham. Even if that person is going to return back to Fargo, they're both very pretty places. I have no horse in that race. So if you went from a place that does not have a tradition and went to a place that does not have a tradition, it is permitted to eat it. So he or she can take that tradition. And there's a lot of versatility in this halachic matter. But what's so fascinating and curious about bird consumption is the value of mesora, of tradition, in determining whether or not you can have it or not. And then finally, just to round it out, but a very important halacha for our purposes, im shar makomot she'in lahem mesoret, yoklim la'ocho al samach makom she'esh lahem mesoret, yesh mi she'asar v'yesh matir v'yesh lachush l'divrei ha'oser. If the rest of the places that do not have a tradition are able to eat and relying upon a place that does have a tradition, there is one who, so there are several opinions, one who forbids and there are one who prohibits, and there is a reason to be concerned regarding the words of the one who prohibits. So the question, so for me, this is a really important se'if in Shulchan Aruch, is what do you do if you don't have a tradition? Can you rely on somebody else? And that's what's really in play when it comes to this Masora. And so, we're spending a lot of time in New Orleans. You have Rabbi Bernard Illouay. Bernard Illouay was a rabbi of high repute, a student of the Chatham Sofer, had a PhD. Don't need to have a PhD to be a really wonderful scholar. And he was very perplexed. He was flummoxed. Why? Because when he came to New Orleans, can I make it larger? Oh, I can. Great. Something happened. And he writes a letter to, if you look, none other than Rabbi S.R. Hirsch, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. V'hine zeh, kimat shmona yirachem me'az. 8 months ago, I came to New Orleans, here in New Orleans, Kila Kadosha Shari Chesed, Leishipo Al Kisei Ha'orah, to become their rabbi, their chief posek, Lagi Lebeit Yaakov, Ma Hayashoa Mayhem, Bahaya. So when we get to our business here, he is invited out to eat, Vayihi. I'm in the last line, eight or nine lines down. The last word. Vehi biyom ha'shlishi leviato. Third day I came to town. Hine v'nikra v'nigrati la'achol lechem im echad me'ovei v'lechatzer beito v'ra'iti Marozat Shonot Mitzurat Mitzuratan Ubinyan Gufan Mikol Ela Asher Anachnu Oklin Behem Nikraim Maskavidak. He can't. Third day, he's invited to one of the Balabatim, and he sees in the backyard that he is raising Maskavidak and he's feeding it. The Velora Iti means that Miami. I've never seen it. I've never seen anybody eat Muscovy duck before. And I've been everywhere. I've been in Europe. I've been in Baltimore. I've been in Philadelphia. I've been in New York. In this barzot, this animal. What are you doing with them? What are you doing in my backyard? What are you doing in your backyard? Asks the way of this person. What do? I raise them in order to eat them. Who said you could do that? I never asked anybody. What do you mean, Rabbi? I never asked the Shaila. Everybody does it. And there's a local Shochet who slaughters all of them. And after all, that makes good sense. Why not? I don't need to ask a Shaila. I know, maybe he doesn't know. We don't know exactly. That why can I eat? Because everybody does it. There is a tradition that this looks good. And Rabbi Ilaway, who had a very, very hard career, and he moves, eventually leaves and goes to Cincinnati. He fights, he had no luck, no mazel when he was in the Americas. He recorded, his son actually produced this book. The response, a very pithy response by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch under Tshuva on page 165, essentially arguing that Ilaway is correct, that the Muscovy duck is not permitted to eat. And normally Rabbi Hirsch writes, a Mesorah, a tradition would be all right, but because it is a tradition that was established in the Americas, although I should say Rabbi Hirsch before the Civil War was very much in favor of migration to the Americas. In his German language journal, Yeshurun, Rabbi Hirsch was very encouraging of people who could afford it. It cost a lot of money to migrate by sail. It takes 3 weeks, and you have to risk your life, basically, with the possibility of disease and on a 3-week voyage across the Atlantic. Rabbi Hirsch, very frequently, a year went by in his journal that was established in the mid-1850s, in which he didn't comment on the possibilities of moving to the United States, but the Civil War. Convinced Rabbi Hirsch that America was backward. They hadn't figured out the slavery issue, even though Catholics, Presbyterians, everybody had figured out that slavery was an abominable thing. In the Americas, it's backward. Religious elites don't have any say in what's going on. And so his mind was turned, because starting really with the Civil War, about the viability of developing a religious community in the United States. And here is a very strong indicator of that. He writes to Bernard Ilaway, again, they're both trained in Germany, that absolutely not, you're correct. The Muscovy duck, and by extension turkey, are forbidden to eat, even though we usually are reliant upon establishing a Mesorah. A Mesorah that comes from the United States is not a Mesorah. And finally, Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, one of, if not the great mid-19th century posek in Europe, in Galicia. We have very little in the way of responsa of halachic literature from Europe to America. So this is a supremely helpful source. So he writes in El Vilcha Shlomo, he was thought to have written over 1,000 works. Many of them are no longer available, but that's sort of the folklore behind, but Rabbi Shlomo Kluger was a supremely important halachic figure in Galicia. Shalatano, benidun ha'ofo tabayim min America. In this, he's talking specifically about Turkey, because they are the ones that are really indigenous to the United States. Hinei ani osra. I've already said, I'm on record, writes Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, I'm saying they're forbidden. And I don't give any truck to the arguments put forward by those Jews in the Americas. Vize yoter mishana. It's been over a year since I made this psak. I issued this. People who are in Galicia, I've written about it at length. We don't actually have that tshuva. The yisod divrei kevan. What's the kernel, the core of my issue? Kevan danan kaimelan. The ein somklin al shum siman. Rak alamisar, because we generally follow the Ramah. We don't rely on any indicators of the anatomy of the bird. It doesn't matter that a turkey looks a lot like a chicken, for instance. We can't rely on it. V'ein lanu alayim masorah. We don't have masorah for turkey. Ma'ishna matirim shayu k'tav ba'amerika. Sheish lanu masorah. Heva yiftza. It's all wastefulness. Literally, Yipatza PM, they don't know what they're talking about. They're full of it. That's his rabbinic parlance of they're full of it. They have a Masorah. Masorahs in America mean nothing. Then in the bold section, Mash'en Kane, Ata, Hine b'medinat America, Nidyashe b'Yisrael, Zah, Erech Me'a Shanim. They've been there for 100 years, but who cares? It's still a young community. When we quote them, Lo Hayasham Yoshev Yisrael, although you could say the same thing about any Jewish community, right? The Jewish community of Mainz wasn't around forever. So in Babylon, they can say. In Or Kasdim, they can say that there were Jews. And in Ar Sinai, they can say it was always a Jewish community. But nevertheless, they don't know what they're talking about. V'od zot yadua ki az ba'o l'sham rak kol mari nefesh, only sort of the scraps of society, v'kol asher, all the desperate people, v'kol asher lo nos of a kali adat, people who really weren't well-versed, weren't Jewishly literate, the ruban, the ein kedai l'smoch alayhem ba'al divrayhem sheish lahem masoret, and you can't rely, now he's not talking about the rabbinic elites, he's talking about the rank and file Jews. These people are not to be trusted. You cannot establish a Masorah in the United States. And yet, we all eat turkey. And so, I think a really interesting indicator of how turkey took off nevertheless, Mrs. Pach, we don't know her first name, unfortunately, has an advertisement that's published in many of the newspapers. Here I've given you one from The Occident in the 1860s, just as this controversy is still very much raging. Mrs. Pach from Berlin takes this opportunity of informing families who may require the services of a competent person to cook and arrange for weddings. She's the very first Jewish caterer, maybe, in brises and social parties, that her many years' experience as caterer affords experience of her ability to cook to the satisfaction of families, either at their residences or her own, as they may desire. She is furnished with ample testimonials. She comes with references from New York and the city, referring to Philadelphia. Special attention paid to boned turkey, French fricassee, etc. And it is endorsed by the rabbi, actually, at Shire Field, Rabbi Samuel Meyer Isaacs. And in fact, there is a push in the American Jewish community, realizing that those people, those rabbis, and really, it's probably more than just rabbis, but the European Jewish communities were no longer taking America very seriously. There are cries for the results of union, writes Isaac Leeser in an editorial. We need to establish our own governance. We need to take our own fate in our own hands. We need to establish Masorah. We need to establish halachic governance. There was much of a cry for a chief rabbi. Chief rabbis never did well in the United States. We need to establish something because we are in need of authenticity, posits Isaac Leeser, because nobody else is taking us very seriously. And now, and you remember Nathan Adler and all that pomp and circumstance and the congratulatory notes that the Jews in the United States, about who he is, his position is going to redound to the success of Jews in the America as well, and the communities in New York and in Philadelphia are congratulating on his appointment, hoping that it will support their efforts here to establish traditional Judaism in the United States. But already years later, and Adler was the chief rabbi from 1846 until he retired. He slowed down in 1880, but still was alive in 1890 until he gave his position over to his son, Rabbi Herman Adler, to be chief rabbi. But now, when we are scattered all over the world, it seems this is an American Jew, writing Isaac Leeser, a grave imputation against us. against the zeal, excuse me, and intelligence of any considerable body of Jews to be without a tribunal of their own. We need to establish and fortify our own rabbinical ranks and in their immediate neighborhood to which they could refer at all times and receive proper answers as a right, not as a gracious favor. We can't rely on other people anymore. We need to establish our own authentic Jewish tradition here in the United States. Our readers are not perhaps aware that the chief rabbi of England, as a rule, this is Rabbi Adler, will not answer a minister, that's a rabbi, or any private person from abroad. And that's true. When I looked at the chief rabbinate's papers in England in the London Metropolitan Archives, I can tell you probably now 10 years ago, if there is a log from the secretary of the chief rabbi of all incoming mail. Rabbi Adler answered all incoming mail queries, halachic questions, at a 90% clip when it came to Jews in England, and a little bit less, a hair's breadth below that for Jews in Canada, Jews in the Asian islands and South Africa, Shanghai. He answered those queries responsibly. He answered, I looked at 4 years, I believe, as I recall, of the record logs. He answered only 25% of questions which came to him in the United States. Maybe because he didn't feel obligated, but also because he did not trust that his word would be followed. He didn't want to deal with it. Our readers are not perhaps aware that the chief rabbi of England, as a rule, but you don't need me to tell you that statistic. You have a historical actor, Isaac Leeser, telling you that, will not answer a minister or any private person from abroad and only attend to questions emanating from officially from a congregation. But even then, he won't answer them. And to carry our conversation over, and I love showing off this map, but first from Tzvi Hirsch Maslyansky, who was a very important preacher who comes from Europe to the United States and he travels, and his sermons, originally published in Yiddish and then translated into English, are full of really interesting notes and sensibilities which he gathered from his traveling throughout America. In one of his sermons, we don't know exactly when it was delivered, called The Disguised Ones, I am certain, this is on the right side, I am convinced that you never heard of such names, referring to French Germans. Let me start from the beginning. Whoever heard of French Germans, German Frenchmen, Turkish Italians, Turkish Russians, or Russian Englishmen? I am certain, I am convinced that you never heard of such names. But we, the children of Israel, we, the chosen people, have invented new kinds of creatures with peculiar hyphenated names, such as German Jews, Russian Jews, Polish Israelites, etc. Especially do these names sound crude and ambiguous here in the blessed free United States of America. He thought this was a Medina Shel Chesed, a golden Medina. Others thought it was a treifin Medina. Here in this great and glorious republic, where the Constitution liberates her new citizens from the ancient chains of bondage, from the yoke of monarchs and crowned heads, here under the protection of the dear and precious flag of shining stars and glorious stripes, very appropriate to be quoting on Thanksgiving, perhaps, here, such divisions into countless groups and parties based upon differences of countries, cities, and towns whence we came must cease. We have to embrace American traditions. There must be no geographic distinction between Jew and Jew in this country. No, dear brethren, here we are neither Germans nor Russians nor Austrians. Here we are, all of us, equally Jews and American citizens. And so while Turkey has taken root because people enjoy to eat it, and it looks a lot like a chicken, although there's a small minority that will not eat turkey. Still, the lingering problem still exists of, can we establish a halachic footing, a Masorah footing in the United States? And I submit that's still a struggle today. So this map is from Moses Richin, who just passed away. Unfortunately, I've been lecturing a lot on Zoom, and I find myself always saying the recently passed. So many people we've lost recently. Here you have a map of the Lower East Side, and you see in the key Hungarian, Galician, Romanian, and Levantine and Russian, Jews, when they came to the Lower East Side, it wasn't a melting pot. They lived in their own spaces. They refused to amalgamate. They refused to embrace their American environs. And Minhag Bialystok. You never heard Minhug Philadelphia, Minhug Portland, Oregon. You never heard of Minhug Columbus. These don't exist. Even today, we talk about Minhug Ashkenaz, Minhug Poland. We are in a society, even in America today, this persists. There's something about the newness of America, the inability to establish traction, to establish Minhugim, to establish Mesorah, to establish tradition. We are still very much part of this religious and cultural politic of how do we negotiate these folk ways, but also try to embrace our American environments. Again, as I said, as a joke before we started, I'm not a political scientist, I'm a historian. I don't solve current events. Thank goodness. But this issue of Turkey, this issue of tradition, this issue of credibility among ourselves and people on the outside is still very present today. How we embrace our origins and our traditions and how we negotiate with the newness of America is still very much at the core, not of our halachic matters and our halachic issues, but I would even submit our very Jewish identities. Happy Thanksgiving.
Okay, thank you. There are a couple of questions. You want, I can read them to you. You can see them on your own. I can read them for you if you'd like. Okay, so Susanna just pointing out that, statues today are very common, that things do change. And,
Economics do, right? There's an article yet to be written about in the Yeshiva University Library, there is a statue, a bust of President Samuel Belkin. And there's a whole issue of how they were able to accept it. Sometimes, and what I say about the statue and all these issues is that their inability to come to terms with it. And finally, we do change our minds and we do different things. The fact that it's coming in America specifically, these issues come to a head, I think is really interesting. Not whether or not the issue was resolved. But yes, absolutely, there are statues. Sometimes okay. Jews, obviously, by non-Jews.
Yeah. Okay, somebody sent me privately, but I'll pass it along. This ties into Rupture and Reconstruction, Chaim Soloveitchik's famous article that there are received tradition versus our book tradition, and who has the power, I guess, to make our received tradition is along the same lines. And of course, Susanna's pointing out I guess I'll turn into a question. Baba was once new, Spain was once new, Ashkenaz was once new, but I don't know if you want to comment on why you think that happens. I have a theory, I don't know if I'm right.
Please, go ahead.
It has to do with modernity and enlightenment. In other words, it has to do with who preserves our Mesorah. And since, with the advent of reform and, that the majority of the Jewish people who came to America were not observant, everybody got tainted with the brush that we can't trust anything, that even the Orthodox are, and then and listen, it plays out today. I think the Haredi community in Israel doesn't really think the Haredi community in America are really Haredi. They're too influenced by America. And I think a lot to do with a lot of modernity, but
I would agree with you about that, but also the topography of North America looks different. It's not ancient. There aren't old castles and churches lining the countryside as it is in Europe. It looks new, and it's discombobulating to religious sensibilities. And it's interesting as well as Christians were able, remember, they call cities New Canaan, Salem. They were able to embrace America as Christendom. Mark Knoll, the great historian of American Protestantism, has made the argument. Jews have not followed in step. They were always reserved. America looks a little bit different, but obviously right, is that we don't have as many sources. There's an abundance of sources when it comes to for American Jewish historians. There are a few sources, but it would be interesting to see the politic of establishing Minhag in these European spaces. Rabbi Kelman, I absolutely agree with your point about modernity. There's also, I think, what the appearance of the America, it looks different. It looks new, not ancient.
I also think it's not so simple to think that Minhag Spain and Ashkenaz were so accepted. We know, like, I think when the Meiri moved or the Ramban moved to, you know, they brought Minhagim from community to community. There were huge fights. It's not so true that everything in the Middle Ages people said is fine. No, our Minhag in Spain was like this. What do you think you're doing in Amsterdam? You guys don't know what you're doing.
Dave Berkowitz has done wonderful work about this in medieval France about this. You also remind me is technology. Remember, is that fact that you had mail and correspondence can come so quickly. People can fight with one, and you can be aware of different people's minhagim. The fact that Ilway is writing to Hirsch and receiving a response within a couple of months, that's not something you could have done in the middle of the Crusades. You were when you were isolated, truly isolated from a communicative point of view, you had no choice but to establish your own minhagim.
Right. That's Danish Berber's article in Tradition, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, that the loss of the local rabbi, which he just wrote a book, now that I'm in the middle of reading The Community Rabbi, everything he writes is, you know, fascinating.
Yes. And of course, he's the great scholar of Minhag.
He knows everything. And, you know, Danish Berber argued, Rabbi Dr. Professor Danish Berber, winner of the Israel Prize, winner of Minhag Israel, argued that because of modern communications, local rabbis are afraid to make any psak. They say something today, and the Gadol Ador in Israel, you know, they get in 2 hours, you know, they get a message back. You can't say that. And it's totally changed the halakhic thing. Whereas 200 years ago, a local rabbi made a psak. Nobody knew about it for 6 months and people followed it. And that was the local, that was meant to be the local rabbi. So, right. Technology plays in a very important role.
And there's a question, I know we're running out of time, but there was a question about DNA. So this actually sadly came up, and there's a literature on September 11th and a stab and trying to free Agunot for people that you couldn't find. Could you use DNA evidence to free these Agunot? And the Beit Din of America took a much more, they made use of DNA evidence, again, with certain levels of circumspection, whereas other Bati Din did not. And so that's a whole other issue of how technology and science plays a role. And again, the fear of it isn't just from the nuts and bolts of halacha, but also the newness of it. I think that I've argued that in a what I call a tradition-bound community, not that they're all... Not that everybody is afraid of new, but it's a question of authenticity. And authenticity, I don't mean what most closely approximates the Vilna Gaon, but I borrow from what the great anthropologist Regina Bendix has argued. What feels right in your kishkas? She didn't use that term. What looks correct? What enlivens my sensibilities? That's the stuff that makes sense. And I think that's probably that from a, it's harder to pin down quantitatively. But if you think about it ourselves, how many times have we, engaged a situation, a condition, from a religious or cultural, social standpoint, it just doesn't look right. Or maybe it looks great. Or maybe in over time, the time has a way of massaging, our concerns, mollifying. All of these, it's hard to talk about, and that's why I think broadening ourselves out in the 19th century in particular as, whether it's modernity, whether it's technology and communication, that's really a, from a chronological perspective, a very interesting moment in which Jews in the New World had to reckon with tradition and what life was going to be like in a place which they had a sense was going to be around with them for a very long time.
I'd also would argue that there is Minhag America. The fact that we skip all the piyutim and they even Artsro puts them in the back of the siddur. Who says Yotzra today? I mean, there's some Yekesha communities that say them, but the truth of the matter, we've done a lot of things, they just happen. And in America,
we don't call it. You're absolutely right. But we don't call that. I mentioned Rabbi Abraham Rice. He tried to get rid of Yotzros, and the Jews of Baltimore said, Rabbi, what are you doing? That's not what our grandfather did. Mm. So all of this, I mean, it's hard to get at it. It's a web, a thorny web of cultural and political and halachic issues that are at play. But you're absolutely right, is that we have developed in North America. It was in Torah and Moshe, I was talking about North America. We always have, we have developed on our own, certain, even you mentioned Haredim in America, and in the yeshiva world in the United States, it looks different. So naturally we have established our own sensibilities in North America. But what's interesting is we still call it minhag. I'm still an Ashkenaz Jew. I'm not a Chicago Jew. Minhag Chicago doesn't exist, even though it may exist.
Yeah, but you have the Boston Rebbe. You've got the Boston Rebbe. You've got, I don't know who else. I can't think of more beyond that, but there must be, which is actually interesting. And Lubavitch 770 has become sort of, you know.
Absolutely. Lubavitch are the most, that's a different talk. Maybe Hanukkah time we could talk about Chabad menorahs, but the Rebbe, remember his father-in-law said, America nisht underish, I can do it here. The Lubavitch in particular have been easily the most progressive enclave in our Jewish community that's willing to embrace the mechanisms of America. From a legal, cultural point of view, they get it more than any of us. Absolutely. Whatever you feel about that,
right?
They get it the best.
Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. We'll let you go. It's 11:05 in Chicago Central Time. But so enjoy. You have a little bit more extra day left. And well, thank you. Everybody can stay on board. Go get a cup of coffee. The same channel. Ari Zivitovsky will be speaking at 12:30, 25 minutes. And then this evening at 8:30, Rabbi Daniel Karopkin, the Rabbi of the Bay, president of the RCA, will be giving our weekly Parshat Hashavush here. That's going to be on the other log on, the regular log on we've been using before. I'll send out an email a little bit later this afternoon about that. But thank you. I don't know. I don't have to get into the problem. I don't eat turkey here. So we don't eat turkey on November the 26th. There's no reason to do that. So anyways, Thursday, November 26th, just one of the regular days here. All right. Have a great day. And thank you very much.
Thanks.